Not since the Black Death struck Ireland in the winter of 1348 has there been such a terrible time with disease. Fintan Craig Doheny. On the day before the Achill Island quarantine, Stephen Browder and Kate O'Gara drove off together to Loch Derg, planning to lunch near Killaloe and then drive on to a cottage on the lake near Clunoon. It was to be a stolen 3 days together before examinations and a hectic summer schedule for Stephen, who now planned to specialize in high-pressure medicine. The cottage, a remodeled farmhouse, belonged to Adrian Peard, who had graduated 6 years ahead of Stephen and already was recognized as an important researcher in pressure medicine and the ailments of divers. Peard, scion of a wealthy old County Cork family, had established a vacation and weekend base at the cottage on the lake, installing a large steel pressure decompression tank in the barn behind the cottage. Stephen had been several times to the cottage, earning money as a guinea pig in Peard's experiments. Since their first sexual experience beside the Mallow Road, Kate had rationed them to one or two repeats a month, and then only at her least fertile times. She had resisted this outing at first because it coincided with her highest fertility period, but Stephen had promised to be careful. Kate, not certain what that meant, had warned, "We'll not be having any bastards in our family, Stephen Browder." They had arranged the outing with care. Kate ostensibly was with her friend Maggie on a holiday in Dublin. Stephen supposedly was boating with friends near Kinsale. Peard, who had guessed the nature of Stephen's involvement with Kate, had volunteered the use of his Loch Derg cottage, "when it doesn't interfere with my schedule." He had handed over the keys with a laugh and the admonition, "Leave the place neat and do try to get in a little time for study. I'd like you with me some day, Stephen. You have a talent for solving unusual problems, such as this one." As Peard had expected, Stephen blushed, as much from the praise as from the conspiracy. The car they took was a tiny green Fiat whose use Stephen had earned, tutoring its owner in the niceties of kidney function, a subject that baffled the Fiat's owner until Stephen hit on the stratagem of a large drawing with signposts on pins through which the student was required to maneuver a tiny cardboard automobile labeled Foreign Matter. It amused Stephen and Kate to call the Fiat Foreign Matter as they drove north. A few minutes before noon they crossed the narrow old stone bridge into Killaloe. The castellated tower of St. Flannery's Cathedral stood out like a Norman sentinel against a gathering of clouds on the horizon. The sky overhead was blue, however, and the lake was a blue and emerald mirror to the surrounding hills, its surface rippled by a light wind and the passage of a quartet of swans. Just north of Killaloe, Stephen stopped at a roadside gypsy stand for sandwiches, chips, and beer, which they ate in the meadow beside the mound where Brian Boru had raised his castle. Their picnic site looked down on Ballyvale Ford, where Patrick Sarsfield and his 600 troopers had crossed the Shannon on the night of August 10th, 1690, during the siege of Limerick. Kate, fascinated by her nation's history and a little awed to be in this very place, began regaling Stephen with the story of Sarsfield's ride when she found him unfamiliar with the details. Watching her color rise as she talked about that wonderful, futile ride against the Williamite siege train, Stephen looked longingly at the concealing shade of the trees that hid the circular foundation of Brian Boru's castle, wondering if Kate might agree to walk into that sheltering bower with him for a time. But he could hear children shouting at the lake below the meadow, and the picnic site soon was buzzing with flies attracted by the food. They wolfed their food and ran back to the car, pursued by the flies. In the shelter of the car, Kate looked back at the meadow and surprised Stephen with a mystical side of her nature that he had not suspected.
"Terrible things were done in that place, Stephen. I can feel it. Could the flies be the souls of the evil men who did those terrible things?"
"Ah, now, Kate, what a thing to say." She did not really cheer up until they turned down the graveled track to the cottage, and she saw the old double chimney pot above the trees. When they entered the cottage, she was almost childlike in her admiration. Stephen, who had come to understand and enjoy most of her moods, took a positive delight in showing her around. The kitchen had been remodeled from its old farmhouse days, a large window added on the lakeside, every piece of equipment not only modern, but the best available. Kate put her hands to her cheeks as she looked at it.
"Oh, Stephen, if only we can have a house like this."
"We will some day, Kate."
She turned and hugged him. Outside there was a small orchard and an area set off by stones for a kitchen garden. The barn stood on the far side of the orchard. It was a stone building with a new corrugated metal roof, and was easily half again as big as the house. A tall growth of weeds lapped against the stone sides of the barn, but the path from the house through the orchard to a small side door was clear and neatly trimmed at the borders. Stephen unlocked the padlock and swung the door open for Kate. He flipped the light switch beside the door as she stepped through. Brilliant illumination flooded the one large room, pouring down from banks of reflectors suspended from the rafters by pipes. The big tank dominated the center of the area. It was a full 6 meters long, 2.25 meters in diameter. There were 2 quartz windows on each side, small and set at eye level, plus another even smaller quartz window in the pressure-sealed airlock hatch at the near end. Kate, who had heard Stephen's descriptions of his stays in the tank, said,
"It's so small. Did you really stay in there 4 days once?"
"It's comfortable enough," he said.
"There's a double-seal sanitary exhaust system. It has a telephone. The only uncomfortable part was wearing all the connections for Peer to monitor my vital signs."
Stephen led Kate around to the far side, showing her the long bench of instruments there, the leads into the tank, and, at the end, the racks and shelves of scuba gear that they used in the lock, and then at the far end, the 2 French-made compressors with their elaborate air filters. Kate peered through one of the quartz windows into the tank.
"I'd be bored silly in there all that time," she said.
"I took some of my books. Really, Kate, it was quite peaceful. I studied and slept most of the time."
Kate pushed herself away from the cold metal and brushed her hands against her skirt.
"I want to make us a fine dinner in that kitchen," she said. "I've never seen such a grand kitchen. Did you get all the things on my list?"
"They're in the boot."
While Kate busied herself in the kitchen, Stephen brought in their suitcases, the separate packs of their books from school, and Peard's blood saturation tables. He left the suitcases on the bed, made sure Kate did not need anything more from the store at the village, then set himself up to study in the tiny parlor. He could hear Kate humming as she worked, the clatter of pans. It was possible to imagine the two of them safely married, a calm domesticity about their lives. The mood stayed with him all through dinner and right up to the instant in bed when he showed Kate how he intended to be careful. He held up a condom that one of his fellow students had bought in England. Kate, her face flushed, grabbed it out of his hand and hurled it across the room.
"Stephen, it's sin enough what we do, but I'll not have that on my soul."
It took him almost an hour to calm her, but then she was especially tender, crying against his shoulder and laughing. They went to sleep with her head cradled against his chest. Stephen awoke late to the sound of Kate again busy in the kitchen. He had not expected this domestic side of her nature, and it filled him with a warm satisfaction. She had the wireless on and was humming along with the music. Stephen looked at his watch on the bedstand, shocked to find it almost 11 a.m., vaguely aware that the music from the wireless had stopped, and a man's voice was speaking with controlled excitement. When he had bathed, dressed, and entered the kitchen, he asked,
"What was that news broadcast? I couldn't make it out." "Oh, just some trouble up at Acco," she said. "Will you be having 1 egg or 2?
3, he said, kissing the back of her neck.
"Can we go swimming in the lake?" she asked.
"It'll be cold, but we can come back here and be warm."
She blushed. Stephen started to turn her around, but the ringing of the telephone interrupted. He was a time finding the telephone behind a stack of magazines on a stand in the parlor. It was Peard.
"Oh, thank God you're there, Stephen. Is your friend with you?"
Stephen hesitated, then,
"Yes, but I don't—"
"There's no time for niceties.
I've been called to a big medical meeting by Fintan Doheny. The subject matter should concern you.
Doheny? The Doheny? What could...
I've not much time, Stephen. A madman with knowledge of recombinant DNA has released a new plague up at Ackle. They've quarantined the place, but no one expects it to be contained there. Now listen carefully. It seems this plague kills only women. It's 100% fatal so far. Now, it occurred to me that you and your friend are at the cottage, and we've that lovely tank in the barn. A woman in that tank with positive pressure in there would be in a pretty effective isolation. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Certainly I understand. But I don't see how...
I've no time to argue. I'm just asking that you do this thing on my request.
Stephen glanced over at Kate, who was standing looking at him.
I don't know if she'd... I mean, you're asking me to... I must be going, Stephen. Do whatever you must to get her in that tank. Get in with her if necessary. Connect the telephone. I'll call you there later. Will you do it?
Stephen took a deep breath.
This plague... It's already killed a number of women. We don't know where else the madman may have spread it. Get your friend into that tank.
Peard broke the connection.
Violence endured too long leads to moral anesthesia. It degrades even religious leaders. Society is separated into sacrificial lambs and those who wield the knives. High-sounding labels mask the bloody reality. Phrases with words such as freedom and political autonomy and the like. Such words have little meaning in a world without morality.
Father Michael Flannery. All but 20 of John Roe O'Neill's letters had been mailed before FBI agents entered the Los Angeles drop with a warrant. The drop was a tiny office room in a brick building on Figueroa near downtown L.A. It was operated by a Miss Sylvia Trotter, a bony woman in her 50s with hair of a wild henna and heavily rouged cheeks. The two young agents, as alike as clones in their neat blue suits, flipped open their wallets to give her a flashing glance at the identification cards, then, like synchronized dancers, returned their wallets to their pockets and demanded to know about the O'Neill letters. What had been her contact with the author of those letters? Had she seen the contents of any of the letters? Not even one letter? What address had the author of those letters given her? They examined her records and took away a copy of her ledger, leaving Miss Trotter in damp and nervous confusion. The agents, trained as both accountants and lawyers, were disgusted with Miss Trotter's laxity. She had not even photocopied the check from the Henry O'Malley who had set up this arrangement. O'Malley, with a false address in Topeka, Kansas, had paid by cashier's check on a Topeka bank. Even before they investigated, the agents knew Topeka would be a dry well. There was no one at the bank who even remembered this O'Malley's appearance. The 20 letters they collected with Miss Trotter's ledger included 5 that suggested the author had anticipated an official visit from investigators. The 5 were addressed to prominent religious leaders and were headed, "Warning to the Authorities." They explained that the madman was hooked to a dead man switch that would automatically flood the world with more and different plagues should anyone interfere with me. Photocopies of all the letters from the madman were among the first pieces of evidence studied at the Denver Isolation Center by the team, as they came to be known. The team's first meeting came 29 days after the Ackle demonstration, a delay caused by political indecision in high places, an indecision which was put aside only after chilling developments worldwide. O'Neill's disease, now being called the White Plague because of the pallor of its victims and white blotches that appeared on the extremities, obviously was not being contained in Ireland, Britain, and Libya. Looseness of the first quarantine had been largely evaded or ignored by high officials, by the wealthy trying to get their loved ones to safety, by financial messengers, criminals, and investigators, and others. White plague outbreaks were being reported all around the world. There was a pocket of it in Brittany.
It contaminated a corridor in the United States from Boston almost to Weymouth. The western slopes of the Cascades, from well into British Columbia, south into California, and to the Pacific, had to be cordoned off under a brutal quarantine. The World Health Organization's list of hotspots included Singapore, Perth, Australia, New Delhi, Santa Barbara, St. Louis, Houston, Miami, Constantinople, Nairobi, Vienna, and these were just the most prominent places. The team had the current list of hotspots and the O'Neill letters when they sat down for their first meeting at the DIC. They met in an underground room, its walls paneled in dark wood. They had a choice of cold, indirect lighting or warmly intimate illumination focused only on the long table around which they gathered. A psychoanalyst probably could have derived deep significance from the fact that they chose the revealing wash of indirect lighting for that first meeting. All six members of the team knew they were there to study each other as well as the problem. Selection of the team's members had cost long hours of searching questions in sound-insulated rooms and by people who raised their voices only for emphasis. The six were divided by nationality, two each from the Soviet Union, from France, and from the United States. It had been planned to introduce other nationals later, but circumstances intervened. William Beckett of the United States pair, who was to become nominal chairman of the team, came to the first meeting with a particular worry that had been ignited by the devastating plague outbreak on the west coast of his nation. Had the area been contaminated by disease fractions that had escaped from an insecure laboratory? It already was suspected that the madman had set up his laboratory in the Seattle area. The others were too busy measuring each other, however, and he saved his concern for later. Ruckerman, who had been Beckett's professor at Harvard, had experienced little difficulty putting his prize pupil on the team. The selection board had been awed by Beckett's talents and accomplishments. Public health consultant on bubonic plague, world-class skipper of racing sailboats, commercial aircraft pilot's license with jet training, a major in the Air Force Reserve, a hobby of creating and solving brain twister puzzles, a consultant on the military code system, Dia Scrambler, a distance swimmer and a generally respected handball player. A molecular biologist, second to none, Ruckerman had said. A Renaissance man. Beckett was a sandy-haired descendant of Scots-English religious refugees. He had the pink skin and pale eyes to go with this ancestry, but features that a college date had described as latent coarse. Beckett had been a college football linebacker until discovering that the constant jarring collisions of football might scramble his proudest possession, a mind to which most puzzles submitted after a skirmish more exciting than any on the gridiron. The college date's prediction had proved accurate. Beckett had large, heavy features, but the mind had improved. Within minutes of meeting François Danza of the French contingent, Beckett had known it would be difficult working with the Frenchman. Danza was a tall, slender, and dark native of Peronne with traces of Celt, Roman, Greek, and Viking in his genes. His obviously dyed hair was swept back in two raven's wings over a face that often appeared blank and empty, except for the large brown eyes. These stared out in constant incredulity at a world of caprice, now glaring, now withdrawn beneath their heavy black brows. Whenever Danza closed his eyes, his face emptied, leaving only that long nose and a narrow, almost lipless mouth. Even the dark brows seemed to fade. As the Brittany expression had it, Danza was as tough as an old saddle. Seasoned by much use, weathered and shaped, he was now a visible repository of valuable experiences. Danza relied on Danza. He knew himself in jeopardy only when traveling or when eating foreign food. Foreigners, especially the English and, by language association, the Americans, were to be distrusted as fundamentally unsound, capable of evil, and would cooperate only under duress. The white plague for Danza merely represented the present duress. In spite of the fact that he looked down his long Gallic nose at Americans, Danza was recognized in his homeland as an expert on all things Yankee. Had he not endured 4 interminable years on an exchange research program in Chicago? Where better to learn Yankee ways than in the hog capital of the world? Danza could understand the capriciousness of life, where this touched on his living arrangements, but not in his laboratory. In the lab, Danza always expected to be eyewitness to the virgin birth, if not the immaculate conception. Certain responsibilities fell upon such an eyewitness. 2 observers of the event could not come up with 2 different stories. 30 eyewitnesses must produce the same account. It was an infallible rule. A pope could rely on no better. The joke in France was that Danza had been put on the team as contrast to his French companion, Jost Hoop. Hoop's horn-rimmed glasses, the slightly bulging eyes, the youthful insouciance of his features, all conspired to a totality that invited sharing. Those who called Hoop a romantic failed to focus on the underlying strength of his fantasy world. He used romance as Beckett used concealed anger. Where Beckett's muse led him to a raging intellectual striving, Hoop's muse was endearing and promoted a gregarious sharing of everything. Successes, failures, joys, griefs. Everything. Threaded through this complex personality was an Alsatian tenacity compounded of both French and German ancestors. It was in part a hangover from early influence by the Roman Catholic Church. Mephistopheles was real. God was real. The White Knight was real. The Grail remained the eternal goal. There was a pattern in this deeply satisfying to Hoop. Without it, he would have been merely a researcher, a man in a white coat, not white armor. Beckett thought Hoop was okay. A little weird, but okay. Danza, however, was a scientific prig of the worst sort. What the hell difference did it make where this team assembled, just so long as the facilities were acceptable? It angered Beckett that he would have to work with this prig for God alone knew how long. He kept the anger sufficiently under wraps that only Hoop suspected. Many people had worked with Beckett for years without realizing that he operated on regular anger fixes. He could find something to anger him almost anywhere, and, thus charged up, went headlong into the problem confronting him. The White Plague was made to order for Beckett. That son of a bitch! That fucked-up madman! What right had he to disrupt a world that, admittedly not perfect, was stumbling along in its usual fashion? Little of this anger escaped an amiable mask. He seldom spoke harshly. If anything, he was even more amiable with Danza, which brought out the Frenchman's most correct and stiffly proper courtesy. It was a matter of mutual fury that amused Hoop. The other member of the U.S. contingent, Hoop observed, was the real surprise package, especially to the 2 from the Soviet Union, Sergei Alexandrovich Lepikov and Darina Godlinsky. They kept looking speculatively at Beckett's companion, Arianna Floss. At 5 feet 6 inches and 288 pounds, Foss was easily the largest person present. The French dossier on Foss judged her one of the 5 or 6 best medical heads in the United States on what her country doctor grandfather had called female complaints. Both the French and the Soviets suspected she was with the Central Intelligence Agency. It was noted that she spoke 5 languages fluently, including French and Russian. Foss had rather small but even features, framed in golden hair, kept trimmed to tight natural curls. Although large, her body was well balanced. At the moment, Lepikov and Danza were verbally sparring for dominance, a matter of revealing credentials as though they were card players turning up their cards, each aware that the other reserved powerful aces. Lepikov, short and stocky, with bushy gray hair over a flat face with a touch of Mongol in the eyes, appeared the peasant to Danza's aristocrat, a fact that each noted, thinking it a personal advantage. Dorena Godolinsky, the other member of the Soviet contingent, showed increasing signs of irritation at the male contest. A slight graying woman who walked with a limp, she had been cursed, as she often complained to close friends, with an aristocratic face. a barrier to advancement in the Soviet hierarchy, where heavy, peasant features are more favored. Abruptly, she interrupted the two men with a coarse Russian curse, adding in English, "We are not here to play little boys' games." Foss chuckled and translated the curse. "She just called Sergei a country stud. What do we have here? Black hat and white hat?" Lepikov scowled at Foss, then forced a smile. He had done the mandatory tour as an observer at the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C., and understood Foss's jibe. "It is I who wear the white hat," he said. "Am I not the foremost expert on epidemiology in my nation?" Foss grinned back at him. The United States dossier on Lepikov had him abnormally concerned with the workings of his liver, a paradox considering the quantities of vodka he was known to consume. These alcoholic indulgences, however, were always followed by bouts of self-loathing, an anguish approaching the pathological during which he dosed himself not only with specifics to which his medical standing gave him access, but also with nostrums and massive doses of vitamins carefully concealed in bottles marked for more ordinary contents. Godolinsky, hearing the boast, muttered, "Peasant." She spoke in English, which brought the attention of the others to her. Beckett cleared his throat and hitched himself closer to the table. Godolinsky, the dossier said, was a renowned codebreaker in the Soviet Union, as well as being a medical researcher in her country's space program. She was considered a top-ranked diagnostician, and her laboratory techniques were rated superb. "We have been introduced," Beckett said. "We've all read the Secret Service dossiers on each other. Perhaps those dossiers contain accurate information. Who knows? I suggest we will learn more important things about each other in the days to come." "I would like to see your dossier on me," Lepikov said. "Unfortunately, I was not allowed to keep it," Beckett said. Godolinsky nodded. Beckett had taken exactly the right tack with Sergei. Spies were everywhere. Admit it and go on. Beckett had intuition, then. Godolinsky knew this was her own strength. She knew her Soviet colleagues considered her unpredictable, but did not understand this. The reasons for her decisions always seemed perfectly clear to her. It was the intermediate steps that the mudheads around her failed to understand, because their minds could not leap, plodding instead like aged workhorses. Lepikov shifted his gaze to Foss's large, well-formed breasts. "Such a body!" He nurtured a secret yen for large women and wondered if, perhaps, "I would appreciate it if you would not stare at my chest," Foss said. Lepikov jerked his attention to Hupp's gentle smile. Foss was not through with him, however. She patted her curly ringlets. "I'm aware, Dr. Lepikov, that I'm the biggest baby doll in all creation." Lepikov refused to look at her. Undeterred, she said, "Don't let that give you any ideas, please. My husband is bigger than I am. That's unimportant, too, because I can take him out any time." Lepikov was not familiar with this idiom. "Take him out?" Foss shifted to earthy Russian, in which she berated him for his inadequate grasp of English. He might know white hats and black hats, but little else. She then favored him with a colorful description of what she would do to his sexual organs if he ever again stared at her in a boorish fashion. This brought peals of laughter from Godolinsky. In Russian, Lepikov admonished, "Act more in keeping with your position." Godolinsky shook her head in helpless mirth, then in Russian said to Foss, "He's one of the new breed in the Soviet Union. They breed them for fat and unswerving devotion to power and sexual accomplishments." Beckett intervened. "There are those of us here who do not speak Russian, and we do have work." Still in Russian, Godolinsky said, "He's right. You two behave yourselves. You, Sergei, I know stories about you that you would not want told here. Be warned. And you, Mrs. Foss, that a beautiful woman should know such language. Foss grinned and shrugged. Lepikov tried to appear amused. It was only a joke. Beckett began pulling papers out of his briefcase, assembling them on the table in front of him. Still simmering, Lepikov realized he had been maneuvered into a secondary position here. He wondered if Foss and Godolinsky had done this deliberately, or perhaps Danzel. And Hupp, he looked so smug. The Soviet dossier on Hupp said he was a prime target for subverting. Was that possible? Hupp had been a student at UCLA, where he often had been mistaken for Latin American, and had even joined a Latino political club. Hupp was a skinny whipcord of a man, the very type Lepikov distrusted most. That dark skin and those soft brown eyes. The eyes of a cow. He is a socialist with susceptibilities of the flesh, the Soviet dossier said. The account said he had been almost irresistible to young, blonde UCLA co-eds imbued with a fanatical drive to fuck for peace. Lepikov glanced at the aging Godolinsky, then at the monumental Foss. Was there more here than met the eye? Beckett glanced at a page in front of him and, in that moment, took over leadership of the team. "I have been ordered to tell you," he said, "that we are not the central investigative team." Godolinsky said, "But we were told." "Why not?" Foss demanded. "There are now 58 major research teams working on this problem worldwide," Beckett said. "We are on telefax and closed-circuit TV communications via satellite. By tomorrow afternoon, we'll have a 12-man clerical and communications team in here, plus at least 30 lab technicians. There will, however, be 2 central clearinghouses for communications, one in East Berlin for all Europe, and the other in Washington, D.C. "Politicians," Foss barked. Beckett ignored the outburst. "Our first order of business is to tackle the problem of a psychophysical profile for our madman. There is now convincing evidence that it was this John Roe O'Neill." "What evidence?" Godolinsky demanded. Hupp raised a hand. "Everything fits. The names of his children and wife, the particular expertise in molecular biology." "We haven't pinpointed his lab," Beckett said, "but there's growing evidence that it was somewhere near Seattle." "Not in Kansas?" Danza asked. "That was a first report," Beckett said. "It's been disproved." "Do you have the new background summary?" Hupp asked. Beckett distributed duplicate sheets to the others from a stack in front of him. "You'll note that his parents died in a car accident the year he graduated from high school," Beckett said. "He was raised by his maternal grandparents. The grandfather died while O'Neill was in college. The grandmother lived to see O'Neill graduate at the head of his class. She left him a moderate legacy and the McCarthy family business." "So many deaths," Lepikov muttered, looking at the page in front of him. "An unlucky clan," Beckett agreed. "Only that aunt in the nursing home in Arizona. Half the time she thinks they're asking about her dead husband." Hupp said, "We are being asked to determine how far we can move against these madmen without turning him against the rest of the world." Silence greeted this observation. "You've read his threats," Beckett said presently. "A dead man's switch," Lepikov said. "A device or arrangement that would loose a new plague upon everyone should these madmen be captured or killed." "Are our hands tied?" Godolinsky asked. Hupp said, "Surely O'Neill must know he cannot totally ignore what he has done." "We have a certain amount of freedom," Beckett said. "This facility. Secret. Superbly equipped. But he warns us not to do exactly what we're doing here," Lepikov said. "We will feel his wrath if we disobey." Danza spoke, his tone mild. "That is why we remain hidden here." Lepikov said, "My associates in the Soviet Union believe this DIC was chosen because it is not in Europe where the plague is most likely to spread." Dunzar splayed his big hands on the table and addressed himself to Beckett. "I came here in the belief that this was the ideal place for a secret and coordinated assault on this plague. I was told this would be the central coordinating facility."
"The plans were changed," Beckett said. "I did not change them."
"Goddamn bureaucrats," Foss said.
Beckett's expression remained bland and amiable. He said, "The DIC may very well become the center of the world's combined medical effort."
"But first, we prove ourselves, eh?"
Hupp asked. "First, we try to understand our enemy. The man, and not the plague," Beckett said.
"Where was this decision made?"
Godolinski asked. "At the highest levels," Beckett said. "Most of the other groups, so I'm told, are also working in this way, as well as on the question of how he spread his plague. That is the highest priority. Can we cut him off and go after him openly on all fronts?"
"Tomorrow we start the medical work, eh?" Dunzar demanded. "When the technicians come."
"That, too," Beckett said.
"Two?" Foss said. "I have received no such orders," Lepikov said.
"There's a telephone in your room," Beckett said. "You're free to use it."
"And who will listen?" Lepikov demanded.
"Our secret police and yours," Beckett said. "Who cares? Call your boss and get your orders."
"Secrecy is our only hope," Godolinski said. "If he is insane, we cannot predict him."
"Who doubts he's insane?" Foss asked. "He's driven the whole world nuts, including the politicians."
"It must certainly be more dangerous to live in ignorance than to live with knowledge."
Philip Handler. Without any particular pride, John thought his lab in the basement of the Ballard House a marvel of ingenuity. The centrifuge that he had improvised out of tire balancing equipment had cost less than $1,000. His freezer was stock home bar equipment turned on its back and with a calibrated thermostat added. It was accurate to within 1 degree centigrade. He had improvised peristaltic pumps from scuba equipment. His cell disruptor was adapted from a used yachting sonar. The electron microscope, a dual-stage 30-angstrom resolution ISI model, cost him the most time and considerable money. It was provided as a consignment theft item by the San Francisco underworld at a cost of $25,000. And so it went with the entire lab. He fashioned the negative pressure research rooms out of plywood and plastic film. The airlock was sealed by 2 small boat hatches, which forced him to crawl into and out of the rooms. It was the only major inconvenience. Before the lab was completed, John was at work with his computer, setting up the full-color graphics of the molecular models upon which he would center his attention. In parallel computer storage circuits, he filed away everything he could ferret out about the ways existing drugs functioned in the body. He paid particular attention to known data on enzymes and specific DNA receptors. It gratified him to discover that many of the most important requirements for his molecular maps were available in canned form, on computer disks or in storage programs that could be bought or stolen. By the time the lab was completed, he had his computer loaded with the elemental building blocks of his project. There was a hypnotic fascination in sitting before the cathode display, watching the double spirals of the primal helix turn and twist at his command. The red, green, purple, and yellow lines took on a life of their own. His mind and the display fell into a kind of unified space within which it was difficult to separate which was in his mind and which in the screen. It seemed at times as if his hands on the computer controls created the images in his head, or the image would be in his head and then appear, as if miraculously on the screen. There were moments when he thought he was actually speaking in the language of the genetic code, talking to specific sites on DNA molecules. During these periods, the actual flow of time vanished from his consciousness. On one occasion, he crawled from the airlock hatch, staggered to his feet, and found it just dawn outside. Investigation revealed that he had been working steadily for 37 hours, with only an occasional sip of water. He was achingly hungry, and his trembling hands could not even deal with solid food until he drank almost a full quart of milk. The structure he needed to see and understand was slowly revealing itself, though, both on the screen and in the computer-monitored outputs of his lab. He knew it was only a matter of time until he fitted the proper molecular key into the biological lock. The answers were here in the lab and in his head. They merely had to be opened out into their own reality. The nucleotide sequences of the DNA encoded all of the genetic information for every biological function. It was a code-breaking problem. Without the computer, he would have been lost. At any given moment, he might be working with 4,000 to 20,000 genes. The mapped arrangements of these genes and the DNA codes within them could project into more than 1 million genes. He did not need all of those genes, though, only the key ones, whose coding lay in the particular nucleotide sequences. By disruption, by enzyme fractionating and temperature-controlled separation with collimators and centrifuge, he sought out the bits and pieces that his mind, computer images, told him were there. Before long, he was fashioning ribosomal RNAs and messenger RNAs from his own DNA templates, selecting and discarding, seeking out the control sites in the genomes. These, and the regulatory proteins, were his first targets. Some 2 months into the project, John realized he would need a special supply of natural DNA for the polymerization cycle. The DNA had to be biologically active, and it had to carry the templates he required. There was no escaping the fact that the DNA material transferred in pairs, one of each pair being a mirror of its opposite number. His head ached with thinking about the problem, but he could not avoid the immediate necessity. It would risk exposure. It was dangerous, but he could see no alternative. A session with his foraging kit gave him a passable identification as a John Vicente, M.D., Public Health Service. He had bought a small hand press early in fitting out the equipment for his project. This now produced some quite adequate letterheads. On these he typed letters of authorization, scrawling big signatures of officials at the bottoms. He bought a dark wig, toned his skin olive, and all the while kept watch through the newspapers for a school immunization date. It came within the week. Announcement of an immunization program in West Seattle Junior High School for the following Monday. Wearing a white jacket with stethoscope protruding from a side pocket and a name tag on his lapel, identifying him as John Vicente, M.D., he showed up early at the school. It was a cold winter morning, and the halls were crowded with students bundled into heavy jackets. He moved through the shouting, jabbering throng without attracting more than casual notice. In his left hand he carried a carefully arranged wooden kit box containing racks of sterile slides and covers and all of the neatly assembled tools for blood sampling. In his left hand was the briefcase with his authorizations. He bustled officiously into the school nurse's office, noting her name on the door. Jeanette Blanqui. "Hi," he said, all innocence. "I'm Dr. Vicente. Where do I set up?"
"Set up?"
Nurse Blanqui was a slender, blonde young woman with a permanently harried expression. She stood behind a long table upon which the immunization kits were set out in orderly rows. There was an empty chair at the far end of the table with two stacks of forms in front of it. The wall behind her displayed a calendar and two bowdlerized anatomical charts, one labeled male, the other female. "For the blood samples," he said. He put his wooden box and briefcase on the table and showed her his identification and authorizations. Nurse Blanqui merely glanced at them while her expression became even more harried.
"Blood samples," she muttered.
"We're supposed to get them right along with your immunization program to minimize the upset of school routine," he explained.
"I was supposed to have two clinical technicians here this morning to help me," she said. "One of them just called in sick, and the other one has some kind of emergency at Good Samaritan."
"No, you. This is all I need. What are your samples for?" We're doing a genetic typing nationally to see if we can identify correlations with certain diseases and immunities. I'm supposed to use your ID numbers, no names. All I need, in addition, is whether the sample is from male or female. Her voice sounded tired.
Dr. Vicente, nobody's told me a thing.
She gestured at the table. And I'm supposed to process 216 students today. More tomorrow. He gritted his teeth. Damn. That's their second slip-up in 2 weeks. Somebody in that office should be fired. Nurse Blanqui shook her head in sympathy. He said, Well, what can I do to help you? Could we get a student in to handle the paperwork?
I've already asked for one, she said.
She looked at the table in front of her.
Could you set up here beside me? What kind of samples will you take?
He opened the kit box, displaying the ranked slides, the swabs and alcohol, lancets, everything neat. Oh, she said. Well, that shouldn't delay us much, doctor. I guess between the two of us we can handle it. When he returned to Ballard that evening, Dr. Vicente had 211 blood samples, each with a tiny pinch of skin cells deftly included. There will be specific differences, he told himself as he removed his disguise in the bathroom, which still smelled of stale tobacco. The genetic information for every biological function, including whether the person is male or female. There is a pattern here into which I can lock a virulent destroyer. The positive intermolding effect of the double helix chains, each side able to reproduce its opposite number, his clues lay in there. In the peptide bonds, perhaps, and in the singular tails that trailed out of the helix. He took the samples down to his lab. The answers had to be in here, he assured himself. It was in the DNA patterns, had to be. When a bacterial virus infected a bacterium, it was the virus's DNA, not its protein, that entered the bacterial cell. Here was the messenger he needed to make John O'Neill's revenge heard everywhere. The technique for testing his results already had been worked out. It would be elegant in the extreme. He would require short-lived virus-mediated bacterial forms, bacteria that would induce visible effects in a selected population. The effects would have to be identifiable and visible, not fatal, but important enough to cause comment. The test bacilli would have to be self-lethal. They would have to vanish of themselves. These requirements, which might have daunted a major research center, did not even give him pause. He had a feeling of invincibility. It was only one step in his project. When he had the key to this lock, when he had assured himself of its identity, then he could start shaping the key into its more virulent form. And then the message could be sent.